A call to order the Commerce Committee. Members are still filtering in. We don't have a quorum at the moment. We're going to proceed with our agenda while we get started. The first thing that we're going to take up is the budget for the Department of Commerce, a presentation from the department. I'm very happy to welcome back to the committee our Commissioner of Commerce, Commissioner Arnold. Welcome back.
And
you
Thank
may
you.
Proceed when you are ready to do so.
All right. You ready? All right. So good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and members. For the record, my name is Grace Arnold, and I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Thank you very much for inviting me back to committee to present on our governor's budget recommendations for commerce, and thanks to Chair Stevenson for carrying this bill. Before we get into the budget items, I just want to spend a minute orienting members of the committee to the department's mission and strategic priorities. So for more than 150 years, the department and its predecessor agencies have served Minnesotans. Our mission is to protect and assist consumers, to ensure strong, competitive, and fair marketplaces, and to engage people and communities across the state in doing that. We protect the public interest through consumer protection. You can move to the next slide. So we have sort of five priority areas underneath that core triangle. So we protect the public interest. We serve as a trusted resource for consumers and businesses. We are working to reduce economic barriers within the industries we oversee. We're working to ensure that all Minnesotans are resilient to climate change and are working to advance efforts to mitigate climate change. And we are ensuring a strong, competitive, and fair marketplace for Minnesotans. So someone told me recently that this was a little creepy, but we're here with you every day, and we actually mean that. So if you're filling up on gas, you'll see a Department of Commerce sticker to see that we have checked to make sure that that gallon you're pumping is a gallon. If you're purchasing a home, you're likely purchasing through a mortgage that our department oversees. If you are taking steps to reduce your energy use, our department has a number of ways that we interact with energy efficiency. And if you're rebuilding after a disaster, you're likely using both your financial institution and your insurance to do that. So I think you and your constituents have benefited from the services that we offer at the department. So this is the high-level overview of each of the governor's budget recommendations. I'm gonna do a brief dive into each of these. So the first is insurance division staffing and operations. It's 1.8 million for fiscal year 2024 and ongoing from the general fund. Just as a bit of context, Minnesota ranks 16th in total written premium in the state, so we're the 16th largest insurance market in the country, but we have the 36th largest or smallest, depending, below the halfway point, smallest department. Most recently, we got accreditation through our National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and they specifically pointed out that we were understaffed and asked us to come seek additional funding to be able to keep up with the volume of work that we have and the complexity. This budget item will help the department to continue to protect the public interest by making sure that insurance companies are adequately regulated, that they're solvent and are monitored, and it will also allow the department to continue being a trusted resource to respond timely to industry questions. The next three that I'm going to talk through are health insurance related. The first is standardized plans. So this is $136,000 in fiscal year 2024 and ongoing from the general fund. This will fund additional staff in the insurance division. This proposal will make plans more comparable across metal level types. So if you're purchasing coverage at a bronze, silver, or a gold level, sometimes it's really hard to tell the differences between the two or between plans within those metal level types. And that will help consumers when selecting their plans, and also it helps protect carriers from inadvertent risk selection. The additional staff person will help to advance Commerce's efforts toward making health insurance simpler and easier for Minnesotans to understand. And we've looked to other states. We're the only state in the upper Midwest that doesn't have these kinds of plans, and we've looked to other states to figure out how they've implemented and in figuring out what we would need. The next is $34,000 in fiscal year 2024 and ongoing from the general fund to codify Section 2713 of the Affordable Care Act into state statute. This statute requires preventive services to be covered and covered at zero cost sharing. It's things like mammograms, colonoscopies, sort of basic services that you would seek in preventive care. Staff will review health plan filings to ensure compliance with the state law, and then we'll also conduct outreach to ensure Minnesotans are aware of the benefits to them through this proposal. The next proposal is free primary care. So this is one-time funds of $318,000 from the general fund to conduct a feasibility study and fund staffing for contract management for a proposal to offer no cost, no barrier primary care to Minnesotans. The cost of the study will be $500,000, and there's an additional $136,000 for staffing. So the goal here is really simple. We want to improve access to healthcare before you get sick and invest in prevention, taking from the model that we used for COVID with no cost, no barrier testing and treatment. That was really successful and one we'd like to implement for basic healthcare. All right, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. We have a $41,000 proposal in fiscal year 2024 and $21,000 per fiscal year ongoing for body-worn cameras for our Commerce Fraud Bureau. With this funding, the Fraud Bureau agents will be aligned with all the other state and local law enforcement agencies that have body-worn cameras. The first year buys the equipment, the ongoing costs buy the data needed, storage needed to retain anything that's recorded on the devices. The enforcement staffing is a staffing and a realignment. So this is $248,000 and ongoing from the general fund. This will fund reallocation and reorganization within the division and add an additional consumer support position. The next is strengthen Minnesota homes. So I believe you heard this. Yeah, so you were visited by our partners from IBHS to hear a little bit more about this. The science behind the proposal, it's a $32.4 million proposal for startup and then $1.23 million ongoing for staffing to support the program. This is a proposal to help Minnesotans be more resilient to our changing climate by providing grants to protect homes against extreme weather events, and it's modeled after successful programs in other states. Our goal here is to improve Minnesotans' health and safety in their homes before a storm hits, and then to ensure that homeowners save money on their insurance premiums when they do have a more resilient home. Next, the Senior Safe Fraud Prevention Staffing. So this is $249,000 for fiscal year 2024 to fully staff the Senior Financial Fraud Prevention Program with two additional FTEs. This will help to ensure that we can accomplish the program's goals of helping those 65 or older and vulnerable adults who may be susceptible to financial exploitation and protected by Minnesota Statute Chapter 45A. So we'll help them either directly through our activities under that chapter or through outreach activities. We have thus far prevented the loss of over $5 million and given thousands of presentations. This will help augment that capacity and help our ability to make sure that we are preventing senior fraud and addressing it if there's suspected fraud. So in the budget bill, you'll see a somewhat lengthy set of proposals. That's the CSBS, which is our Conference of State Banking Supervisors Money Transmitter Model Act. So I think for those who've been on the committee for a while are familiar, we have a number of national organizations that are sort of our colleagues in other states. When there are certain issues that need to be have some harmony across states, then those organizations will work on model laws that can be enacted to create some fairness and consistency across states. So this is a model act that would, and a one-time increase in fees that would establish a common regulatory baseline across the country for money transmitters. It'll also help to achieve, to advance multi-state harmonization in the money transmission industry so that companies that are doing business in multiple states have a little bit more consistency. will also help the states to work better together in licensing, regulation, and supervision of money transmitters across state lines. So it does a few things. It modifies definitions, eliminates some technical differences between states that make compliance really difficult for companies that are operating in multiple states. It provides certain exemptions from money transmitter licensing to promote consistency across states. The licensing process, including standardized determinations of who's in control of a license and vetting process. So a lot of this is sort of basic things so that there's consistency across states, so that when you are a money transmitter, you can kind of, you know, if you're here or in another state, you can know that they've been held to similar standards. It would also enable multi-state licensing and enhanced supervision, so it will allow states to work together on the supervision of these companies, which is super helpful. We do a lot of work with our colleagues in other states. If there are any additional questions, we can get into this, but I'll sort of keep that at a higher level right now. Last is a proposal to maintain our current service levels. So this is 1.5 million and 2 million in each subsequent year from the general fund, 20,000 and 41,000 in each subsequent year from the Petra fund, and then 27,000 and 54,000 in each subsequent year from the workers' comp fund. These go toward cost pressures, including maintaining our current staff in a challenging labor market, increasing IT costs, and sort of the general cost of doing business in the state. So I wasn't trying to go faster than I did in the Senate, but I think I did. So thank you.
Appreciate your efficiency.
Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for the commissioner. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kelly, I find the last slide humorous that she makes the presentation, but you get the questions.
That's by design.
Commissioner, welcome back. You can tell who's the commissioner and who's not, right? Madam Commissioner, we heard a bill in committee discussing my words and not necessarily the bill's words, but, you know, hardening and fortifying homes to be able to be more damage resistant in events. And I believe that in your proposal to the committee today, there talks about investigating and looking at and making recommendations or implementing a premium savings on there. Is that correct?
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair Stevenson, Representative O'Driscoll, yes.
And that also has some of the other, thank you, Mr. Chair, that also has some of the other loans and things that are with it to be able to help folks to be able to work on that. I guess my question to you is, how are we going to you know, be pulling that together? Are you going to be visiting with the industry folks to collect data on that, to be able to make sure it's actuarially sound on that, we're not just arbitrarily coming up with a number and saying here's what it is, where it could be more of a savings or less of a savings to make sure we kind of hit that mark actuarially sound like we see with some of the other senior discounts and some of the other kinds of things that are offered out there?
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair Stevenson, Representative O'Driscoll. Yep, that's why there are is a bit of staffing in our insurance division to look at that actuarial analysis and make sure that the discounts are actuarially sound.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Arnold. Because, you know, we do have have concerns. I know that others do as well. Whenever there's a storm event or a weather event, it seems like the first people on the scene, even before rescuers get there, are some of these folks that are kind of the here storm will travel, to be kind of generous with what they're trying to do and get in and get folks moving and stuff. And I want to make sure that we've got a solid standard and that we know what we're doing and that we're be able to have that. So if I can use the term storm chasers, don't come in and multiply the problems that we have right now that your office gets from some and Dolly gets as well from some of those kinds of claims that are coming in.
Chair Stevenson, Representative O'Driscoll. Yep, I think that's the nice thing about the way the program is designed is that there is a standard that's been vetted and has certification criteria, and so that's why we've looked to that standard. So when there is a home that's built to that standard, the discount and the grants fall to that standard, and that's the idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Arnold, I would love to have the opportunity to get you and I on a calendar together, kind of sit down and walk through that or some folks from your office, because that is intriguing to me anytime a consumer can save money, but I want to kind of get an idea of the background and how that works with the because it's going to be a statutory issue here as well, like we do with the for lack of a better term, 55 alive, where there's a statutory requirement on that as well. So just kind of curious, since it's going to be in statute and not something that is organic by the insurance carriers, although they would probably know from themselves and their claims and stuff as to how would be the best rate on that. But if it's going to be a statutory, I'd like to just visit with you and your staff a little bit more about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Arnold, I'm sure you're willing to meet with Representative Driscoll, but beyond that, I don't know if you have anything you want to add.
No.
Okay. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Arnold. I'm wondering, you know, you had in your brief presentation, you talked about the staffing needs for the insurance division. I'm wondering if you can tell us overall how many new FTEs are included in this budget.
Commissioner Arnold.
The Representative Stevenson, Representative New Brindley. So overall, so I'm going to combine energy and our the rest of our department. So we've asked for a total of 52 new staff members.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And next question on the free primary care for Minnesotans. Sure. Obviously most folks are covered under managed care, even, you know, I mean, if they are using, or if they qualify for medical assistance for Medicaid in Minnesota, or if they're in Minnesota Care, most of those programs are managed care plans in which they receive primary care and they receive preventative care, certainly is usually no cost with those plans. So what group of people are we trying to serve in with that study, I suppose, that you're doing?
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair Stevenson, Representative New Brindley. So I'll give the example. I tried to or went through my annual visit process the other day, and it said, if you're here for preventive care, that's fine, but if you ask any other questions, you might get a bill. Which then I'm not going to ask any other questions or I'll get a bill, right? So the idea is that you go to the primary care physician and there's no cost to you. What that looks like, I think, you know, so that's across all Minnesotans. If you're between jobs, if you have really high copays that would prevent you from going to a primary care physician, if you or provider, you know, there are a variety of reasons that people have barriers to accessing primary care, and the idea is to lower those barriers.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this would apply to anyone for any primary care visit. That's the intention. I guess I would be a little bit cautious with that. I mean, there's a reason that we have cost sharing, and some of that is because I have family who will go to their primary care physician if they have a stubbed toe, and that is not helpful to the system either. So there are some good reasons for cost sharing, but I look forward to seeing how that plays out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Arnold?
No further comment.
And I'm not seeing any members seeking additional questions. So thank you, Commissioner Arnold. Appreciate you coming and joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, we do have a quorum. So now we will briefly take up the minutes here. Representative Katiza Watun.
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the minutes.
Representative Katiza Watun moves approval of the minutes from March 15th, 2023. Discussion to that motion. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes from March 15th, 2023 are adopted. And then the next item on the agenda requires us to change seats. So we will do that.
Members, the first bill on the agenda for today is House File 100. Chair Stevenson, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I move House File 100 be recommended to be re-referred to taxes.
All right. Chair Stevenson moves that House File 100 be recommended to be re-referred to the Taxes Committee. And Chair Stevenson, would you like to go ahead and move and describe the A83 amendment?
Madam Chair, I move the A83 amendment. This amendment, and this is the reason why we are back in the Commerce Committee, members will remember that we devoted a whole hearing to House File 100 earlier in session, and there were issues raised in that committee, as well as others that we've been working on for some time related to the licensing provisions in the bill, and having reached some conclusion to those discussions, we thought best to come back here to adopt those provisions. So I'd say while there's a fair amount of changes in the 883 amendment, I think the two headlining changes are, one, a resolution to the issue that has been lingering related to the hemp industry, in particular people who are concerned about how the previous structure, or the current structure that's in the bill, would impact hemp only businesses and their federal taxation, and some of the other regulatory requirements that are currently in House File 100. So what the 883 amendment does is it create a separate licensing track for hemp, low-dose hemp retailers and low-dose hemp manufacturers, that will enable those businesses to have a license from the state that does not, that does allow them to produce or sell low-dose hemp-derived products, but does not allow them to produce or sell cannabis products, and thus they can operate within the confines of what is currently legal under federal law and not have any tax consequences from 280E. It also eliminates some of the cannabis regulations that don't make sense in the context of a low-dose hemp market. So the example that, I will drive to first is the separate facilities, which would be very difficult, for example, for a brewery making low-dose THC-infused beverages. So we address those issues. We also make some modifications to some of the vertical integration limits on the cannabis license track, both adding some more detail on the manufacturing and retail side, and raising some of the limits on the cultivation side. There's corresponding changes in the other amendments, or the other articles of the bill, excuse me. This amendment also contains two provisions that were offered by Representative West in the Transportation Committee last week that I said that I would take in this committee, and we are doing that. So it reduces the amount that a person of cannabis that a person can possess in their own home from 5 pounds to 1.5 pounds, and it eliminates the requirement of diversity plans. We also have some miscellaneous provisions in here, including limiting the grant programs to micro businesses to further provide support to those small businesses that we are hoping will be the engine of the new cannabis market in Minnesota, changing some of the penalty provisions in here, some technical changes, some clarification around employee testing language, and some provisions related to implementation that were requested by the administration. That is probably a good discussion of what is in the A83.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, any discussion to the A83 amendment? Ideally, we will discuss the amendment, the bill as amended going forward. So we will have plenty of time for member discussion and questions then as well. All right, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. The motion prevails and the A83 amendment is adopted. So Chair Stevenson, would you like to have any further comment on the bill as amended, or would you like to go to?
No, ma'am. Chair, I think members are familiar with the bill, so we can probably just go right to the
very
testimony.
Good. Members, as the chair mentioned, we have already had a very robust discussion and much public testimony on House File 100 previously. So we have asked testifiers who signed up today to keep their remarks confined to the amendment and keep their remarks brief, as we have a number of other bills on the agenda for the day. So first, we have Kayla Fearing, followed by Glenn McElfresh, and you'll have 2 minutes for your testimony. You can introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson. My name is Kayla Fearing, and I am a native Minnesotan and owner of Healing Fear Consulting, a healthcare science-based cannabinoid education business. I recently returned back to St. Paul in October 2022 after working in Michigan and Illinois cannabis markets for almost 3 years. My background before cannabis was healthcare. The cannabis industry is an extremely fast-paced and regulated industry, just like healthcare, but it makes the type of money healthcare could only dream of. I'm not even referring to California, Oregon, or Colorado. I have personally seen and worked with this type of money, and I would like to highlight some of the statistics our Midwestern cannabis industry, which I hope will include Minnesota sooner than later. Last year, Illinois made $1.8 billion in the adult-use cannabis sales industry. Michigan made $2.3 billion, and as of December 22, they were a record-setting $221 million. Recreational adult-use cannabis is taxed in every state that is legal. Illinois is 35%, one of the highest in the country. Michigan is 10%, the second lowest in the country currently. Illinois from the Minnesota border is 5 hours and 22 minutes. Minnesota to the lower peninsula of Michigan is 9 hours and 51 minutes. Minnesota to the upper peninsula is 6 hours and 25 minutes. If Minnesota legislators continue to think that Minnesotans aren't accessing cannabis in legal markets themselves, you're far from wrong. Think in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, when our parents and grandparents were taking coach buses to Canada for cheaper accessibility to prescription drugs. That's what's happening now with cannabis. In Michigan, I worked 25 minutes outside of Detroit, and we averaged 1,600 guests a day. 30 to 40 of those people a week came from Minnesota, including Minnesota medical patients, because Michigan offers reciprocity to United States medical patients, meaning if you're a tourist to Michigan, they want all patients to have access to their medicine. I believe that this is something Minnesota's medical cannabis program should adopt immediately if we're as innovative in healthcare as we claim. In Illinois, I worked 30 minutes outside of Chicago, as well as
ask you to wrap up.
I'm almost done. In Gurnee, Illinois, near the Wisconsin border. I wasn't working a counter at these jobs, but I did sure see multiple Minnesota license plates in those dispensary parking lots at shops such as Rise, the same dispensary we have here in Minnesota, part of our medical program. In Illinois, they do not offer reciprocity, but they offer a 15% discount to medical patients on your total bill. Minnesotans were shopping in Illinois because even with a 35% added tax, the product will still be available in larger quantities and higher doses than the Minnesota Medical Cannabis Program or our recreational program that's being suggested in these amendments. If we adopt an adult-use recreational program with limits, we will continue to be laughed at by legal Midwestern states. Many Minnesotans who choose to shop recreationally should be on a medical cannabis program. However, due to the stigma of cannabis, veterans, doctors, politicians, teachers, and clergy all shop recreationally instead and self-diagnose and medicate. If you put in place potency caps, possession limits that are naive.
I apologize, but your time is up.
Okay, so keep Minnesota money in Minnesota.
Thank you for your time. Glenn McElfrist, you can introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Next up is Angela Dawson, if you'd like to come up and take the second chair so we can continue moving quickly.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify on HF 100. My name is Glenn McElfrist, and I'm a co-founder of Plift, a black-owned hemp-derived beverage company currently operating in Minnesota. I'd like to thank Representative Stevenson for meeting with us and his willingness to consider our recommendations since our discussion. Many of us in the Minnesota hemp industry had great hope for this long-awaited amendment. Unfortunately, after reviewing the amendment over the weekend, we still have major concerns regarding this bill. For background, THC, or hemp-infused beverages manufactured by Minnesota breweries, are edible cannabinoid products defined at 229.24 in the 7th engrossment of HF 100. Edible cannabinoid products, which also include gummies, are included in the definition of cannabis products, edible cannabis products, and hemp-derived consumer products. Following the adoption of the amendment, the only businesses that are legally authorized to produce and sell these cannabis products are cannabis businesses, which means that on July 1st, 2023, businesses currently manufacturing and selling federally legal and recognized hemp-derived THC beverages and edibles must stop immediately. If not addressed, this change will hurt popular Minnesota breweries that manufacture these beverages like Bent Paddle, Fair State, and Bauhaus, as well as restaurants like Craft & Crew, Estelle, and Pat's Tap that sell them. More importantly, Minnesota consumers will either wait years for Minnesota's adult-use cannabis licensing authority to be established, or they will turn to the illicit market and out-of-state sources for these THC beverages. Members, please don't allow a final bill that shuts down businesses who are currently meeting consumer demand for THC. Please don't hurt small Minnesota businesses who are providing jobs and seeing massive success in this market, just so big national cannabis businesses can benefit. In its current form, this bill is allowing the interests of a few special interests to prevail over the interests of Minnesota consumers. We've been told that there's a temporary licensing solution, but have not been able to identify any place in the bill that this is located. It is important to note that the 60% of Minnesota businesses that currently sell low-potency THC products are BIPOC or women-owned. On July 1st, 2023, they will have to let employees go or shutter their businesses. The illicit market in Minnesota will grow, and our communities will be less safe. Minnesotans across the state will be confused, disappointed, and angry about why the legislature would remove an innovative, progressive, and equitable model and replace it with something that only large companies can survive in. Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, and members, thank you once again for the opportunity to share these comments on behalf of the hemp industry.
Thank you for your time. Next, we have Angela Dawson. Not sure if she's with us. Next on the list is John Dugas. You can come up to the table and introduce yourself and proceed. We'll come back to Ms. Dawson if she's here. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, and thank you, Chairman. My name is John Dugas, and I was born and raised in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I currently reside in Stillwater, Minnesota, and run a business called Superior Molecular that's based out of White Bear Lake, Minnesota. I am very proud to have Superior Molecular's logos featured on many of the cans of your favorite breweries in the state of Minnesota. Our ingredients are used by more than 50 companies that depend on us for our water-soluble THC ingredients. Our laboratory has grown from just one employee, me, to a company that employs nine others who I rely on a great deal. We credit the safe and successful rollout of the hemp edible cannabinoid market to responsible leaders in this industry. Unfortunately, oversights in the drafting of this bill could kill the hemp-derived THC supply chain in Minnesota. Additionally, I believe certain vertical integration limitations are incongruent with the bill's goals and would stifle the development of testing infrastructure in the state of Minnesota. The supply chain issues would arise from caps on hemp canopy sizes for farmers and manufacturers alike that are truly intended for the cannabis-only market. This, combined with a ban on the importation of federally legal hemp, would create an imminent supply chain disaster. To continue operations in supplying Minnesota businesses that we currently serve, we distill about 2.5 kilograms of THC every month. If we are to quantify that in terms of hemp, that small amount would require a canopy size of roughly 522,000 square feet to produce annually. The reason is that hemp is primarily grown outdoors and harvested once per year. But if Superior Molecular were to be a licensed manufacturer of cannabis products, its production would be limited to the amount of biomass that could be grown on 15,000 square feet annually. This is not anywhere near the demand for my small business. The growing and manufacturing of hemp products in Minnesota should not be tied to the cannabis industry and should not be limited by caps or importation. Since July of 2022, the entire industry has been in need of local quality control companies that can provide not only quick results, but accurate ones too. And despite the market vacuum, nobody has stepped in to fill this void. Given this situation, I propose there be no vertical integration limitation on any businesses seeking a license for the purposes of cannabis quality control testing services, so long as they don't test their own product.
You just wrap up.
The oversights in this bill could cause serious harm to businesses that have grown organically from the inception of the Department of Agriculture's pilot hemp program.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Next, we have Veronica Alfaro, followed by Ted Gallaty. Can introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, please.
Hi, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Veronica Alfaro, and I am here as a cannabis advocate, educator, mother of three children, and owner and operator of a Latino-owned cannabis company based out of Eagan. I want to be mindful of your time, so I'll keep it to 2 points. One being that I am 100% in support of HF 100. Minnesota has a great opportunity to do its people right, especially those that have been disproportionately affected by the war on drugs, and it's about time. We deserve a bill that is for the people, by the people, and destigmatizes the plant. My second point is this. According to the Oxford Dictionary, that the American dream is the ideal that every citizen of the United States should have an equal opportunity to achieve success and prosperity through hard work, determination, and initiative. I'm the proud daughter of immigrants who came from here from Mexico. My parents showed me what it is to work very hard, overcome challenges, and strive to live the American dream. With that said, achieving the American dream of owning a small business doesn't happen overnight, especially in the cannabis industry. It takes time, resources, and financial means. We must make sure we are creating low barriers of entrance in the market that align with equal opportunity and prevents unconscious bias that includes startup grants in order to create those gradual key stepping stones for small businesses here in the industry to achieve success. One way to do this is the ability to utilize the insured spaces to reduce costs, share resources, and build community for small businesses. We appreciate the author's continued efforts in making sure we get this done. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Ted Gallaty. You can introduce yourself and proceed, and we will have Nathan Ratner next. You can approach the bench.
Yes, my name is Ted Gallaty. I'm the owner-operator of Willow's Keep Farm in Zumbrota, Minnesota. We also grow hemp maize, Minnesota, the first cannabis maize in the country, and we also have the Old Pine Theater in Pine Island, Minnesota, where we sell our products out of a performing art venue, and we are adding Sacred Mounds Farm in Hagar City, just over the Red Wing Bridge. Why am I here? Well, hemp's in this bill 71 times, and I'm a hemp grower. A83 dropped, and I've read through most of it, although it's 155 pages, so unfortunately I haven't gotten through the whole thing. So the first thing, Article 1, Section 9, Subdivision 5, no importation into the state of Minnesota, any hemp-derived products. As I just told you, I have a farm in Wisconsin. That's going to make business very difficult. We also bring products in from Colorado, California, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Arizona. And I ask you, do any of these other businesses like alcohol, tobacco, have the same restrictions? They don't. They can get hops, mash, grain. All their products are distributed across state lines. This is going to be directly against the 2018 Farm Bill, and you should all read the U.S. Constitution. There is the Commerce Clause that will educate you more on that. We can't restrict commerce, and this is an interstate commerce commodity, so it needs to be moved through state lines. Okay, number two, if I were to take part, again, this is A83, you can look at Article 1, Section 28 and 29 and 30, micro businesses, meso businesses, retailers, you are only allowed one license. You will not be able to be a hemp grower. You will only choose one of those. That's, again, not fair. I want hemp out of this bill because I could be a hemp grower over here and I could set up a cannabis, adult use cannabis business over here. But right now, if it's as it is, I will have to shut down, shutter my hemp business. I will fall into 280E. And I will lose all my tax exemption, and my business and my farm will go away. Okay? So these are some extreme things that you need to look at, you need to address before you push it into conference and change things that will affect me, my family, my employees. As you've heard, these other businesses, they have employees too. I employ people, and I have my family running my farm. So please, please consider that. Other things, A83.
Mr. Gallaty, if you could.
I'll wrap up. Yep. 1526, there's still a cap on CBD and CBG and low potency items. I want to see that taken care of because CBG and CBD can actually lower the high if you are on a low potency edible. I'll go ahead and wrap up, but there's other things I have in here, and I will continue to review that and send those to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Gallaty, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name. Mr. Ratner, you can introduce yourself and proceed. We will follow Mr. Ratner by Matt Schwant with the House, so you can approach the bench.
My name is Nathan Ratner. I'm the Vice President and Co-Founder of The Great Rise and an Advisory Board Member of the MN Is Ready Coalition. Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to offer oral testimony again. I am here to testify in support of the Amendment A83, specifically the Advisory Committee inclusion, which is found on line 16.20 and through 17.14. And I will say on that concept came out of the People with Lived Experience of Prohibition Committee within the Great Rise. And I will go speak to specifically the definitions of social equity applicants, which are found on line 42.15 through 43.40, and which also touches on an inclusion in the license selection criteria found on 43.20 through 43.21. Our mission is to ensure that those who've been disproportionately harmed by prohibition disproportionately gain in legalization. I know the authors of the bill, Chair Stevenson, Representative Cha, Representative Cagle, and Representative Tabke, have been steadfast on this issue. And the inclusions within the definitions of social equity applicants directly speak to, directly translate this into impact, as well as ensuring shared equity across the state of Minnesota. Specifically, the first definition of social equity applicant, which are those who have been convicted or are closely related to those who have been convicted, directly affects the the folks who most deserve to benefit. The second provision is that we would be, to our knowledge, the first state in the nation to include retired National Guard or service in the license selection criteria.
I'll have to wrap up, Mr. Rayner.
Yeah, thank you. The other definitions within the bill ensure that this would be amongst the strongest definitions of social equity applicants in the country. And so thank you.
Thank you for your time. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson and committee members, thank you for your time today. My name is Matt Schwantz, and I'm the co-founder and president of Bauhaus Brew Labs, a craft brewery located in Northeast Minneapolis. And we produce, distribute, and sell a Tetra-branded line of hemp-derived THC beverages since last July, when the amendment was passed to allow small amounts of hemp-derived THC in edible cannabinoid products. And I'm encouraged by the amendments to the House's seventh engrossment of HF 100 that were adopted at this committee hearing earlier today. It appears to me that there has been a good faith effort to preserve the lower potency hemp edibles market that the legislature created last July. Now let's finish the job. I'd like to highlight three lingering issues to the amendment. First, there's currently no grandfather period within which businesses like mine could continue operating in the hemp-derived space as of the effective date of the legislation, July 1st, 2023. As of that date, only the Office of Cannabis Management can issue licenses to lower potency businesses, and that office won't exist in any meaningful form as of July 1st. So there should be a grandfathering period in there. Second, under the amendment, transporting lower potency hemp products would require two staff persons in the delivery vehicle. This not only seems inconsistent with the spirit of the carve-outs for lower potency products that exist elsewhere in the amendment, but it would also be nearly impossible to enforce, as this provision also requires that the transporting vehicle bear no markings to indicate that the vehicle contains THC products. In fact, it may have the unintended consequence of giving law enforcement probable cause to stop brewery-branded vehicles at will. Third, the requirement that lower-potency retailers display these products, quote, behind a checkout counter where the public is not permitted, end quote, is unnecessarily impractical and would prevent many, if not most, liquor store retailers from carrying these products. Retailers should be able to merchandise the lower-potency products in their beverage coolers on the sales floor, which, frankly, many of them are doing currently. With some additional revisions, I really do think that this bill could be a model for the rest of the nation on how to allow the marketplace for federally legal lower potency hemp products to coexist with adult use cannabis. Thank you for your time and consideration. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Schwant. The remaining two testifiers, Carol Moss and Susan Burns, can approach the bench. Ms. Moss is first. You can introduce yourself and proceed. And is Angela Dawson here as well? Yes. All right. We'll come back to you.
Susan, how are you?
Ms. Moss, you can go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Carol Moss. I'm a partner at the law firm Helmuth & Johnson, representing a number of businesses in this industry. I also proudly serve as a board member for the National Association of Women Business Owners, our Minnesota chapter, which is the oldest chapter in the country. And I'm here in support of 883 and House File 100. And I ask that this legislature, this committee, not let the goal of perfection derail achievable good. I ask that you support this amendment and support 100 because of the scope and growth potential this industry can provide Minnesota women, an opportunity to have a seat at the table at the beginning rather than play catch up. There are two huge reasons why we should support women-owned businesses. First, women who own businesses are more likely to be the sole or main breadwinner of their family. If you support women-owned businesses, you lift families. Second, women business owners tend to take into consideration their employees and their employees' families when making business decisions. Again, this goes back to lifting American families. The current hemp law, while it has some problems, has given rise to strong women-owned businesses in Minnesota. We have Grounded Gardens, Balance, House of Oilworks, Cake and Bake, Ms. Jane Accounting, Minnesota Essence, Blend Strategy Marketing, And these are just the tip of the iceberg of what Minnesota women can do with this industry. The current hemp law and hemp-derived products have allowed these businesses to begin and prosper. Allowing them to continue will be an on-ramp for these businesses to grow before entering the cannabis industry. Again, my ask is that we don't let the goal of perfection derail achievable good. Therefore, support women-owned businesses today and in the future. We need House File 100 as amended. This bill is far from perfect, but it provides good, solid bones for this new and growing industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moss. Ms. Burns, you can introduce yourself and proceed, and then Ms. Dawson, you can approach the bench and will be our last testifier.
Thank you. I'm also an attorney in the industry, and Carol Moss and I are in the same industry, but we often disagree. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Stevenson. Thank you for the honor of testifying before you today. My name is Susan Burns. I am an attorney in St. Paul. I have a legal master's degree in food and agricultural law and policy. I am a member of the International Cannabis Bar Association and frequently speak across the United States on cannabis legal issues. And I have the honor of being included in the top 200 global cannabis lawyers. I'm here today to express concerns with the amended House File 100, and I don't share the same optimism as my colleague because I don't see any specific carve-outs for women-owned businesses. In fact, women-owned businesses, I think, will be devastated along with a lot of the currently thriving hemp-owned businesses in Minnesota. So while the amended HF 100 does a lot toward legalization of adult use marijuana, it continues to adversely impact the hemp-derived industry, and Minnesota's hemp-derived model is the leader in all 50 states in this nation. So I think we need to work harder to try to protect that. All efforts to date appreciated. It's impossible to meaningfully address the legal issues in this in 2 minutes, but I've distilled 5 general categories of concern, and I have 5 categories for proposed resolution. First category of concern is definitions. This bill unnecessarily redefines scientific and legally acceptable terms that have been in use for decades, if not centuries. Second, it limits the hemp industry to Delta 9 and 2 other cannabinoids in inappropriate amounts. As was mentioned before, there are many more cannabinoids and in higher amounts that have been safely combined and sold to Minnesota consumers since 2019. It creates an Office of Cannabis
Management. I'm going to have to ask you to
no
wrap
way.
Up.
Okay. Hemp and marijuana can coexist, but we need a lot of work on the hemp side. And thank you for the opportunity. I'm available for questions.
Please. Thank you for your time. Right. Ms. Dawson, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson. My name is Angela Dawson. I am the co-founder and CEO of the 40 Acre Cooperative. I'm a farmer in northern Minnesota and a cooperative development specialist. I've been working in the space of agriculture, equity, and economic innovation for a little more than 2 decades. And I've also been working within the hemp space and working with the plant as a cultivator, as a seed supplier, and as an organizer of socially disadvantaged farmers in the region for the past 5 or so years. I've been engaging in various research and community initiatives around these issues, and I'm hoping to contribute to the conversation so that we can onboard a safe and equitable cannabis economy here in Minnesota. So I'm here to weigh in. I'm kind of agreeing with both the two previous speakers. I'm in the middle about some of the things. I know we couldn't get some of the language in the bill that we wanted to get in the bill. And I'm also here to offer gratitude to both the authors who have taken on a significant, enormous task here, as well as the writers and the researchers who are executing toward putting together a really comprehensive bill that is taking on so many issues of our state that deals with the social and economic challenges that have not been addressed for decades. And we're just all doing it within a few hundred pages. So to the point, I will acknowledge that many people have weighed in on what's good and bad in the bill, and a lot of people have an opinion. Some are here only to advocate for their own economic interests and concerned about their own investments. And some are clouded by their own, you know, other ambitions. But I know it can be challenging to mitigate all of these different competing interests. And so I really do want to applaud the authors for all of the work. I read the work that was just published over the weekend. It doesn't touch on everything that everyone wants. But having said that, I will just mention a few things that I'm really concerned about. Because some of us are fighting for folks that don't have a voice, that don't have the capacity to come here and testify, that don't have access to this office. And but nonetheless, they are key stakeholders in onboarding a safe market for us all to operate in.
You can address those issues very briefly. Your time is.
And so I just want to say that the two issues that I have, small issues in the bill, are around the cooperative language. I think that it was unintentional. I think some of the errors are unintentional. And I just want to say that even though it's unintentional, it's more anti-cooperative than encouraging a cooperative marketplace in the industry. So I will make myself available to work with the authors and all of you and whomever else at your convenience in order to right-size the bill and make it right for everyone. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
To be a team player. All right.
Members, we're going to now move on to amendments. Representative Tabke, would you like to move and describe the A-72?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. We have the A-72 amendment, which comes from when this bill came to the Ag Committee. Dr. Dabney up there is testified there about the need for additional research in the state of Minnesota on cannabis seed. And so he'll make a quick statement about that, and we'll come back.
Thank you, Representative Tabke. Dr. Dabney, if you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Clement Dabney. I live in 51B. I earned my master's in plant breeding and molecular genetics from the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences, and my PhD in cannabis molecular genetics and genomics from the College of Biological Sciences at the University of Minnesota. I'm testifying today to advocate that the committee pass Amendment 72 to HF 100, put forth by Representative Tabke, that results in the creation of grants that create and allocate funds for the University of Minnesota for a University of Minnesota extension position focused on cannabis, as well as create grants for funding cannabis research to focusing on genetics and agronomics of cannabis. By the allocation of a small fraction of the tax revenue generated by the sale of cannabis products, these changes to HF 100 would result in faster and more innovative Minnesota cannabis science. Genetic and agronomic research in cannabis will speed innovations in genetics and agronomic practices associated with higher yields, which improves sustainable growing practices and decreases the environmental impact of the Minnesota cannabis industry. A cannabis extension educator would provide modern research and contemporary research to those stakeholders and business owners in the cannabis market space. The University of Minnesota currently engages in cannabis molecular genetics and genomics research. So while working on my PhD, I contributed to and helped write the paper, A New Cannabis Genome Assembly Associates Elevated Cannabidiol, which is CBD, with hemp introgressed into cannabis. The genome that we produce from this work is used as the model genome by the NIH and NCBI, and we lacked federal and at that time state funding, but we were still able to produce the best cannabis genome that exists. With a secure and reliable grant funding source from Minnesota, we will be able to maintain Minnesota's position as a leader in cannabis research. I testify in support of Amendment 72 and hope that the Commerce Committee funds research and innovation by passing this amendment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Dabney, for that explanation. Chair Stevenson?
Madam Chair, I'd ask members to vote yes on the A-72 amendment. As was mentioned, this was discussed in the Ag Committee, and the language has been refined and is ready for adoption at this point. I'll also note, importantly, on lines 1.3 and 1.4, the appropriations to the grant program are unfunded right now, and this is consistent with the general practice we've had to this bill that we're not adding money to the bill until we have the full fiscal note and revenue estimate. So this is right now the policy language we're putting into the bill, and the money would follow once we have a fiscal note and a revenue estimate.
Okay. Members, any discussion? Representative Woodruff-Skoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a comment to follow up on the bill author's comment about fiscal notes. He's exactly right. We have not seen a fiscal note on any of the stuff that we've been, most of the stuff that we've been putting through committee, and not knowing what our targets are going to be, that's becoming a little bit challenging, I suspect, to be putting budgets together. So I'm curious to see when we do get our fiscal notes back on a lot of different projects that are being worked on here in the legislature. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, and to that point, I will note that it's not anticipated. In fact, I can speak with some authority that this bill will not be funded out of the Commerce Committee's budget target. That 100% will not happen. This bill will likely travel standalone with a target in a other bills category or something to that effect. So we will be having a robust budget discussion in this committee as soon as next week when we have the opportunity to consider the our budget that we're passing out of this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, any further discussion to the A72 amendment? Seeing none.
Sorry, I was just like, I know Chair Stevenson, this really probably irritates you because it's really an agronomic question, but just for the scope, just to understand the scope of what this research is about and why it's important, the number of phenotypes in this area, I have no idea how many phenotypes there are, but as we go forward and we're looking at using our acreage, our water, all of those things efficiently, I think that this research is really important, and I encourage a yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. All right. Members, all in favor of the A72 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed?
No.
No. All right.
The motion prevails, and the A72 amendment is adopted. Next, we have the A81 amendment. Representative Perryman, would you like to move and describe the A81?
Yes, Chair, I would like to move A81. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. There has been a lot of work in it, and I do thank you for that. It's displayed by the amount of paperwork I carry around when I come to Commerce or to Health that this is coming to. So my amendment basically is increasing the funding in the bill for drug recognition evaluators. It takes it from $500,000 to $10 million in fiscal year 2024 and takes $500,000 to $5 million in fiscal year 2025. The dollars would be appropriated from the general fund to the Minnesota State Patrol for its drug evaluation and classification program, going for drug recognition evaluator training, additional phlebotomists, and drug recognition training for peace officers as defined in Minnesota statutes section 626.84 subdivision 1 paragraph C, and required continuing education training for drug recognition experts.
Thank you, Representative Perryman. Chair Stevenson.
So, Madam Chair, this kind of ties into the discussion we were just having. The policy language to add more drug recognition evaluators is already in the bill. What this amendment does is increase the amount of funding. I agree and have said in multiple other committees that 500,000 is not a big enough number, but I'm not going to commit to a specific number at this point until seeing the fiscal note and the revenue estimate. So for now, I would ask members to vote no on the amendment, but we will be revisiting this issue once we do have a fiscal note.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I recommend a yes vote on this, and I'd actually ask for a roll call. I think it's that important that we treat this new entrant into the scene very much the same way that we treat alcohol and other kinds of drugs and things. And my A84 amendment will get two more of that, but we'll just put it in there as a kind of a marker to remind us that we all agree that $500,000 is not enough money for this, and to be able to help detect the potency, I should say, the presence of certain THCs and other in presence of individuals, because it can be a problem just like alcohol. Excuse me, like alcohol is if individuals are driving or operating vehicles in an intoxicated fashion. So I strongly encourage a yes vote on the Perryman Amendment.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would echo Representative O'Driscoll's comments, and thank you, Representative Perryman, for the amendment. It's not magic, it's just math. $500,000 does almost nothing for us. $10 million will give us 250 of these trained folks across the state. 250 across the entire state is a drop in the bucket of what we probably actually need, but that's what $10 million will get us. And I am happy to run through those numbers with anyone who would like to see them. I've got very detailed numbers on where that $10 million comes from. But again, it's a drop in the bucket. And I would just ask Representative Stevenson, I understand that we're waiting on a fiscal note to put all the pieces together, but I guess I would just ask what the plan is if the revenues are coming in lower than you'd hope to be able to fund things like this most critical piece, are you open to raising revenues to cover them? Will you cut funding in other places of the bill? How are we going to make up for this? Because this $10 million really is needed for this particular program.
Chair Stevenson, any comment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, I don't disagree that the drug recognition evaluators are necessary. The bill is headed next to the taxes committee, and we're going to have a conversation there about what the tax rate will be, and we're probably not going to have that conversation until we see a fiscal note and a revenue estimate when we can look at everything holistically. And it's not about this specific appropriation. We have not, and I got the receipts, I have said no to all sorts of requests that people have asked for in this bill, many of which are meritorious. I think this is a good idea. I think we should do it, but we're going to wait until we have the numbers so we can make a big decision in total. And we will have a conversation in the taxes committee about what the effective taxation rate should be.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the explanation, Representative Stevenson. The reality is there are items that are critical that should be funded regardless of how things shake out later. And this is one of those things. This is absolutely mission critical if we are going to pass cannabis legislation. And so while it may be consistent to not fund anything right now, there are certain things that should be funded. And there are certain things that even if in principle we should say, yes, this is an item that will be included in the final language. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Stevenson. I appreciate your approach, and I wanted to make a case in point, which is that I have very much lobbied Chair Stevenson to include money for local public health. Now, why does local public health need money? Because they need to do a lot of the education, some of the enforcement. I mean, having the messages out there about kids' use and so on is extremely important. I would say, in my estimation, as important as this, maybe more so. And so, you know, if you're voting for this amendment, you're saying, I don't care how much local public health gets as long as, you know, we put this ahead of that. I'm not willing to do that. I don't think any of us should be doing that. There's plenty of time to have the discussion when we see what the pot of funding is, what the actual needs are. And so I really support the chair's methodology in that way with a big, complicated bill like this. And so I'm going to happily, for that reason, vote no on this amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Newbridge.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To be clear, I also advocated for that funding. Thank you.
Okay. Members, any further discussion on the A81 amendment? Oh, Representative Perryman.
If I could just ask, please vote for this, and I do it in the matter of fact, and Chair and Representative Stevenson, that I didn't go the right avenues. I'm passionate about it, and I know you all are, but I ask for a vote of yes to this because it's, I know the concept, Representative, you said is there, and we're just not putting a dollar sign behind it. And I know you're waiting for the fiscal notes and what this will have on the industry, but it's very important for the safety of all drivers and passengers on the roads today and our public safety police officers. So I really ask for a vote of yes today from all of you, but those are my comments. Thank you for listening.
The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
No.
Stevenson, no. Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
No.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Yes.
O'Driscoll, yes. Representative Cha.
No.
Cha, no. Representative Doubt.
Yes.
Doubt, yes. Representative Dotseth.
Yes.
Dotseth, yes. Representative Freiberg.
No.
Freiberg, no. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, no.
Cleavorn, no. Representative Cagle.
No.
Cagle, no. Representative Kraft.
No.
Kraft, no. Representative Liebling.
No.
Liebling, no. Representative New Brindley.
Yes.
New Brindley, yes. Representative Niska.
Yes.
Niska, yes. Representative Perryman.
Yes.
Perryman, yes. Representative Farr.
Yes.
Farr, yes. Representative Tabke.
No.
Tabke, no.
There being seven ayes and nine nays, the amendment does not prevail and the A81 is not adopted. Following that, the A84 amendment, Representative O'Driscoll, would you like to move and describe the A84?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Many of the testifiers today brought forward that there were limits that were on the potency of marijuana that would be being sold for consumption in their states. And we heard as low as 10% in Michigan and as high as 35% in the state of Washington, but the high as 35%. And so what I wanted to make sure is that Minnesota put some guardrails in place. Washington has had the opportunity to have legal sales of marijuana in their state longer than Minnesota has. Perhaps we can adopt some of their best practices in adopting a ceiling of no more than 35%. We still do have in this state a 3-2 beer, and we still have various types of intoxicating liquors that would still give a range that growers would be able to use to try to meet their various customer needs and their various customers' desires. But again, it would put a top limit on what we would do. And primarily, the purpose for offering this is, again, so the sky is not the limit. We also have research that has shown us, and previous testifiers have talked about persons under the age of 25 who may be higher, have a higher disposition to different kinds of mental illnesses as a result of the consumption of this. But some may say, wait a minute, Representative O'Driscoll, if we make that age 25, then we don't have a problem. Anybody here who thinks that by making the legal age of alcohol consumption at 21, we don't have any adolescents or younger people consuming, have I got a deal for you? And I'm just wanting to put guardrails in here so that we can be able to help folks and to be able to, again, address some of the concerns of folks in the medical profession and others who have been in my office. Madam Chair, given the way that the last one went on the roll call, I'm going to ask for a roll call on this one as well. This is such a reasonable approach that I can't imagine that we wouldn't want these guardrails. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. I ask members to oppose the A84 amendment. It's worth noting that with one or two exceptions, almost every other state that has legalized cannabis has not adopted a potency limit. Representative O'Driscoll makes reference to Washington State, which bills have been introduced in Washington State but have not been adopted. In fact, I'm looking at a news article right now indicating that those bills are dead for this year. So I'm kind of puzzled by my colleagues make reference to what's happening in Washington State. They're not adopting a potency limit. It's also worth noting that we don't have corresponding potency limits for alcohol. You can buy alcohol of very high proof quantity in liquor stores. I don't believe that this is a workable concept. We've considered it in multiple other committees and rejected it, and I'd ask that this committee reject it as well.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious as to why this is not a workable provision. Certainly, there are testing requirements throughout the bill. All of these products are required to be tested. So it is certainly workable then to know what the potency is and to limit the sale to those that are 35% and less. And I would point out that, frankly, the vast majority of marijuana available falls under that limit. It's not like this is some strict limit that is going to be a huge burden on the cannabis industry. And yet it is reasonable to say that the safety of Minnesotans is worth a cap. This is a safety issue, and we should vote yes.
Chair Stevenson.
I would just add that the reason why it's not workable is also the reason why it's not correct to say that the vast majority of cannabis is necessarily below this. Vape technology almost all of the commercially available vapes on the market are 85%, including those that are sold in Minnesota right now in the medicinal marketplace, which is why a 60% cap there is not workable. Again, almost every other state has rejected this proposal.
Members, any further discussion to the A84 amendment? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
No.
Vice Chair Cotizza-Watoon.
No.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Yes.
Representative Cha.
No.
Representative Dowd.
Yes.
Representative Dotseth.
Yes.
Representative Freiberg.
No.
Representative Cleavorn.
No.
Representative Kegel.
No.
Representative Kraft.
No.
Representative Liebling.
No.
Representative New Brindley.
Yes.
Representative Niska.
Yes.
Representative Perryman.
Yes.
Representative Farr.
Yes.
Representative Tapke.
No.
There being nine nays and seven ayes, the amendment does not prevail, and the motion does not prevail, and the 884 is not adopted. So now, members, we will go to discussion on the bill as amended. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm hoping, actually, that is Ms. Burns still here? I'm wondering if she would stand for a question.
Ms. Burns, you can approach the bench. You can go ahead with your question, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Burns, if I was paying attention correctly, I think every testifier we heard with concerns with the bill shared concerns regarding the hemp provisions, and you had mentioned definitions, and I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about the concerns with the definitions in the bill.
Ms. Burns.
I can, Madam Chair, Committee, and Representative, I'm sorry I didn't catch your name.
New Brindley,
thank you. You know, the interesting thing is just starting from the get-go, it redefines the genus cannabis, which has been, it's a scientific name, and it's legally and scientifically been used as to describe the whole plant. So it co-opts that definition to marijuana only. It excludes hemp from the definition of cannabis. So, like, I was trying to think of an analogy why that particular definition is important, and I was thinking of, you know, like if we did something with, like, replacing all the elm trees we lost and we decided to redefine elm as deciduous and co-opt the name of deciduous, which is a scientific term for a type of tree, and then we'd have to redefine elm, maples and oaks and whatever, and what does that do on a federal level when deciduous may be included in federal grants and when they change, you know, I mean, it's unnecessarily confusing. What we mean to do here is to legalize adult use marijuana. Let's call it marijuana, and then we don't have to go through, there's a ripple effect there, because then we go through this whole gyration of redefining hemp and hemp-derived products. There are like four or five definitions. I still don't know what a hemp-derived cannabis or a hemp-derived consumer product actually means as it's redefined. I'm having real trouble tracing it through with all the definitions. I think it's excluded this time from synthetic cannabinoid, which it should be because it's not a synthetic. But then synthetic cannabinoids are referred to elsewhere in the bill in ways that make me think that, well, maybe they meant to include it. Another definition is artificially derived cannabinoid. Hemp products are defined as artificially derived. Most hemp products are not artificially derived. The cannabinoids naturally occur in the plant, and they can be safely extracted using a food safe catalyst, which is not permitted in this bill. So I think what I applaud is the effort to exclude synthetic cannabinoids from the marketplace, and all the hemp businesses want that, like THCP, THCO, very dangerous. They should be excluded, and those are true synthetics. They are synthetically manufactured. They are not naturally found in the hemp plant. So I think we need to do a lot of work
on these definitions. Also take lower potency hemp edibles as a definition. 5 milligrams of hemp-derived THC is the same as 5 milligrams of marijuana-derived THC. No difference. It's the same. So why are we now calling a hemp-derived cannabinoid lower potency? And some people have said to me, isn't that confusing to consumers because they'll think it's lower potency so they can take more?
Thank you.
So those are just a few of the examples.
Thank you for that, Mrs. Burns. Representative New Brindley, a brief follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question would be then to Representative Stevenson, why did you include different definitions than the federal government's definition of hemp and marijuana? Because does that not create potential problems down the road as marijuana products continue towards legalization and certainly at the federal level?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, we are drafting a Minnesota-specific bill that solves Minnesota-specific problems. We're the only state in the country that has done what we've done with hemp-derived products, and we are trying to create a marketplace here that works both for the legalization of adult-use cannabis and for the continuation of our hemp-derived products. And the definitions that we've adopted, we believe, will allow us to continue that. This gets very complex very quickly. I'm happy to discuss it further with you offline if you'd like.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is very complex, which is why it's very frustrating when we are cut off on these conversations. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stevenson. I wanted to ask for your thoughts on a point that another of the testifiers had made about the hemp-derived products and the prohibition on importation. I think he's referring to on page 29, line 27, subdivision 5. Importation of hemp-derived products, and in particular, I'm trying to understand: are there products that are currently legal in interstate commerce under federal law that we are prohibiting the importation of into Minnesota? Because that does seem like a potential dormant commerce clause problem.
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Niska, we've got a lot of other bills on the agenda today, so I'm going to be real brief. But we can talk about this more offline if you like. I think that was an incomplete characterization of what the bill does. It requires certain types of licenses to do certain types of importing, and we can talk more about that offline if you like.
Okay, thank you.
Members, I will give Chair Stevenson the final words, and we'll move on to the other bills on the agenda.
Thank you for the great discussion. I ask for a yes vote.
All right. Chair Stevenson renews his motion that House File 100, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Taxes Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say nay.
Nay.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 100, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Bonner, you're up next. And I will give the gavel back to the chair.
All right. The next item on the agenda is House File 2503. If you are leaving the room, I'll ask you to try and keep any conversations until you're outside the room. We have a lot of other bills to discuss. House File 2503, I will move House File 2503 be recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Bonner, to your bill, and if you could please keep your comments as brief as you possibly can. We are very stretched for time today.
Yes, we will try to be as quick as possible here. The bill before you today is pretty simple and straightforward. It ensures that fully credentialed trained pharmacists and supervised technicians who are essential part of the care continuum may get paid for the services they perform for patients in the pharmacy setting. These services include specifically the administration of basic maintenance medications such as Vivitrol for the treatment of alcohol or opioid use disorder, OUD, or essential services they provide like vaccinations, health testing, and other medication management services for our patients. 2 years ago, we authorized pharmacists to prescribe, counsel, and administer health screenings and work with patients attempting to quit smoking, and we made it easier for women to obtain contraceptives. All these worthy services take time, effort, and expertise to deliver, making it essential that we pay pharmacies for the care and time they devote to the services they provide. A trusted pharmacist is often an essential piece of the care team for patients that consists of dedicated professionals, starting with doctors, nurses, and clinicians. By having pharmacists and pharmacies as a partner in patient care treatment, we provide patients across the state with convenience they want, with the access they truly need to their care. with more than 5 million Minnesotans living within 5 miles of a pharmacy. This is also about access, both in rural and urban areas. Our local pharmacies form the cornerstone of our communities, with many patients seeing their pharmacists more frequently than their health care provider. Ultimately, providing these services in the pharmacy is part of that continuum of care, meaning lower costs for patients and payers, as there are no additional fees, and most importantly, we ensure better patient care and outcomes. This, as a fully credentialed pharmacist and it makes sense that fully credentialed pharmacists should be making should be paid for the services they provide to meet our communities where they are. This bill ensures that local and independent pharmacies in greater Minnesota and our urban centers can continue to provide these services, ensuring their survival and the ability to thrive in our communities. With that, members, I have before you two letters of support, including the National Association of Drugstores, Minnesota Groceries, Retailers Association, as well as the Minnesota Society of Health Systems Pharmacies, the U of M College of Pharmacy, and the Minnesota Pharmacy Association. And I have with me today two testifiers, Mr. Lindu, who is a pharmacist and past president of the Minnesota Pharmacy Association.
Okay, first we have Jeff Lindu. Mr. Lindu.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as stated, my name is Jeff Lindu. I am a pharmacist, a past president of the MPHA, and retired after serving 42 years with Thrifty White Pharmacies, a Minnesota-based pharmacy organization. I am here on behalf of MPHA and the Minnesota Pharmacy Alliance. I want to thank you for hearing House File 2503 today. I also want to thank you for the confidence that you have shown in pharmacists' ability to serve the healthcare needs of Minnesota citizens by passing legislation in recent years, giving pharmacists the authority to prescribe and administer certain medications. The ability to implement those authorities is why we're here today. From the beginning, we have maintained that if we are going to provide services that might otherwise be provided by a physician, we need to bill through the same medical networks as a physician and not through the pharmacy claims processing network. The barrier that we have encountered, and I will state that this barrier is largely with employer self-funded plans. Many of the Medicaid and other providers in Minnesota do pay, but the employer self-funded plans are a huge part of the market, and that's our primary barrier. When we bill them, we get as a response, quote, not covered for provider type, close quote. They don't recognize a pharmacist as a provider for those services and therefore don't pay. As representative said, many of these services require a rather lengthy session with the patient to consider the appropriateness of providing a medication, smoking cessation, and so on. No one in healthcare today, or frankly any business today, can provide that level of service without being reimbursed.
And Mr. Lindu, I have to ask you to wrap up your testimony.
We do believe that payment for healthcare services is key to the economic survival of Minnesota's community pharmacies. Again, we thank you for the confidence that you've shown in pharmacists, and unfortunately, we find it necessary to come back to you to ask for assistance that will help assure us that we are being paid for those services. Be glad to answer questions.
Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I am the Government Relations Director for Medica. However, today I'm speaking in my capacity as a member of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I'll keep my testimony abrupt. I want to start by thanking proponents for initiating a dialogue and for continued discussions surrounding House File 2503. Members of the council raised a number of questions and operational considerations which the proponents incorporated into the bill, and I'll touch on two of those. One was adding some language in Section 6, just asking that we have an open dialogue between regulators and stakeholders. So as this law is getting implemented, should it pass, We have a place to answer some of those operational questions, such as, does the pharmacist want to use their pharmacist ID, or do they want to use the pharmacy ID? A lot of details. We want to make sure there's some time to work through those pieces. And that leads to the second one. We asked for an implementation date of 1/1/2025, specifically to give us a runway to ensure that we implement this bill effectively. I'll conclude my remarks by echoing the public health benefit that the proponents have mentioned in previous testimony, particularly as it relates to vaccine administration. We know when you make the healthy choice more convenient, it's going to improve vaccine uptake. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Discussion to the bill. Seeing no discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 2503 be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 2503 is recommended to be re-referred to Health, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Bonner.
You, Mr. Chair.
The next item on our agenda is House File 1459 from Representative Freiberg. Representative Freiberg, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you. I will move that House File 1459 be referred to the General Register.
Representative Freiberg moves House File 1459 be recommended to be placed in the General Register. Representative Freiberg, you have the A1 amendment. Would you like to move and describe the A1?
Yes, this amendment reflects the substantive discussions we've had with stakeholders, and it narrows the breadth of the bill.
Discussion to the amendment. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Representative Freiberg, to your bill.
Yes, this bill seeks to restore the right of Minnesotans to obtain compensation and justice through what's known as the Private Attorney General's statute for consumer frauds committed against them by unscrupulous operators in violation of our Consumer Fraud Act. That right was taken away by the courts in 2000 in the Lee versus Nystrom case, and this bill will give that right back to consumers. Just want to say thank you to the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform Coalition for engaging with us on this legislation and helping with the crafting of the amendment. I will ask for your support, and I have one testifier.
All right, we have Mr. Elwood here. Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I'll just be available for a question, but I would like to just to say thank you to Ms. Pampu for all her help this session and specifically on this bill and this amendment, and we really appreciate it. Thank you.
We are also big fans of Ms. Pampu here in the Commerce Committee. Discussion to the bill. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Freiberg. I just want to, again, ask the same clarifying question I asked in the Judiciary Committee, because you did invoke the private attorney or mention the private attorney general statute. And I just want to make sure we're crystal clear that what we're doing with this bill is creating a separate parallel private right of action outside of the attorney general statute. And just want to make sure that's clear for the record.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes, that is correct. This is a new, the original version of the bill referenced that directly. This is a new section within the consumer statute of Minnesota statutes.
Representative Niska?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Freiberg. I thank you for that clarification. I really do appreciate the work that you've done on really trying to target this bill very narrowly on a very specific problem. And so thank you for the work, the negotiation you've had with stakeholders on that.
Further discussion to the bill. Seeing none, Representative Freiberg, closing comments and renew your motion?
This is a great bill. I hope members will support it.
All right. Representative Freiberg renews his motion that House File 1459 as amended be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? No. Motion prevails. And and House File 1459 as amended is recommended to be placed on the General Register. Okay. The next bill on our agenda today is House File 1751 from Representative Petiza Watoon. And once you are up at the table, I will let you move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1751 to be before the committee for possible inclusion.
Representative Petiza Watoon moves House File 1751 be laid over for possible inclusion. You have the DE1 amendments.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The DE1 includes some definitions and incorporates some additional technical assistance from Ms. Eng from Fiscal Research, and just gets the bill in the shape I would like.
Discussion to the DE1 amendment. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. DE1 is adopted. Representative Katiza Watoon, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Members, House File 1751, as amended, provides a one-time appropriation total of $500,000 for the coming biennium to Exodus Financial Services, doing business as Exodus Lending. Exodus Lending assists Minnesotans by refinancing payday, car title, and pawn and personal loans. Even with a 36% rate cap on short-term small-dollar loans,
Exodus Lending expects continued community demand through other high-interest loans. Since their founding in 2015, Exodus Lending has served borrowers in 39 Minnesota counties, refinanced over $515,000 in loans with an average interest rate of 311%, and helped keep an estimated $1.6 million in family budget and local communities that would have been stripped in fees and interest if communities remained stuck in predatory debt cycles. Section 1 of the bill is an annual appropriation of $150,000 that will assist Exodus Lending in building out their program, operational and direct lending capacity to better serve low-income and financially excluded Minnesotans and help them reach financial stability. In Section 2, there is a one-time $200,000 appropriation that Exodus Lending will utilize for a revolving loan fund on character-based loans in referral from community-based nonprofit providers. That funding would complement $176,000 that they have already raised, allowing Exodus Lending to serve more Minnesotans. I'd like to first introduce Ann Leland Clark, the Executive Director with Exodus Lending and one of my constituents.
Wonderful. And Ms. Leland Clark, if you could limit your testimony to 2 minutes, we would really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, proud to be your constituent. My name is Ann Leland Clark. I serve as Executive Director of Exodus Lending. As mentioned, we were founded in 2015 out of the Holy Trinity Lutheran Church community in South Minneapolis with a social and economic justice mission to get families out of predatory debt cycles. And today we refinance. What that means is up to $1,500 of payday, auto title, online installment, and other loans carrying an average interest of 311%. We recently expanded our portfolio and launched the upstream small dollar consumer loan product called the Resiliency Loan. And we are piloting with 5 nonprofits. I'm joined here by Melissa, one of our partners with Neighbors, Inc. in Dakota County. The Resiliency Loan, it provides up to $1,200 for urgent and emergency expenses. And in just 2 months of the pilot, the product is flying off the shelves. We've enrolled 30 borrowers and lent $30,000 in capital who are using it to pay for car repairs to stay employed, for security deposits to become stably housed, or for back past due rent to prevent homelessness. Early results are showing we are reaching financially excluded and exploited Minnesotans with credit scores that are keeping them from accessing the mainstream. But we are bridging the gap between the non-bank and banking market by reporting to credit bureaus. And so we also, in addition to reporting to credit bureaus, we connect people with financial counseling, coaching, education, and that's how we're bridging the gap to build financial power and resiliency so people can move to the mainstream products. We use a community-based revolving loan fund of individuals and faith-based investors, and this bill would essentially double our revolving loan pool, as well as expanding staffing and operational capacity to just really meet the demand that our pilot proved. We're in the pipeline to become a community development financial institution, or a CDFI, and are unique in Minnesota of offering consumer small dollar loans. We got a lot of small business CDFIs, folks doing home loans, but we're unique in consumer small dollar loans. So we have great, like other regulated financial institutions, we work closely with the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and we have great banking and lending lawyers to ensure that we comply with state and federal fair credit reporting. The support of this would allow us to foster and model equitable banking, advancement economic justice, and test solutions to expand credit in communities of color who have been extracted historically. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. You read my mind. And then we have Ms. Melissa Barola.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify today. My name is Melissa Barola. I work for Neighbors, Inc. as a bilingual financial empowerment coordinator in South St. Paul. Neighbors is a social service agency that helps struggling people who are trying to improve their lives. I work alongside people who are experiencing financial difficulties with rising cost of food and housing. Many of their struggles are intensified because they do not have access to safe and affordable financial products. I talk with people every day and learn the reason they can't walk into a bank or get a loan or a credit card. I listen to parents whose credit was damaged during the pandemic when they lost their job. I hear from people who have avoided using credit cards because they don't want to get into problems. Unfortunately, this means they do not have a credit score, which prevents them from getting a loan. Exodus Lending Resiliency Loans are a solution for people with these problems. In 2 short months, 5 of our clients benefited from a resiliency loan from Exodus. Unlike grants or government assistance, these loans are built on the strength of the participant. Participants are not looking for a handout. They are strong, resilient, and purposeful people who need a little help to make ends meet and continue their path to financial well-being. We didn't have this option for them until now. Your support of HF 1751 will enable us to continue to offer dignified, cost-effective, and empowering resiliency loans to underserved people of Dakota County. There is nothing else like this out there for us to turn to. This is a unique opportunity for lending institutions, nonprofits, and government to work together towards a common good. Wealth inequity is a complex problem. We can't solve it alone. We can start here together. Thank you for your opportunity to testify.
Thank you. We'll move to discussion to the bill. Discussion to the bill. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Patiz-Watoon. I'd like to draw your attention to the DE of lines 1.13 and 1.14. And I think what we're trying to get at there, I think maybe some better wording there would be barriers to financial inclusion means a person's financial history. Because we're not talking about just banks. Here there are other financial institutions, so I think a financial history and then credit history and credit score requirements and scarcity of financial branches, I think. So I'd recommend that, and I'd love to work with you on it in the future. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Patiz-Watoon.
Thank you, Representative Farr. I appreciate your expertise in this area and would definitely be happy to consult.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Patiz-Watoon. I just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I know this is kind of the kinds of products we should be lifting up, the ones that really help people and are not predatory. And so thank you once again for bringing this forward.
All right, seeing no further discussion. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Patiz-Watoon, and perhaps this is for the testifiers, I'm not sure. I'm wondering if your clients meet requirements for other public assistance programs, or do they fall into a category where they're not qualifying for public assistance programs, and therefore you're looking for another option?
Ms. Leland Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative, really, honestly, so there's no requirements. That's a great question, because some programs you require to be part of a public benefit program for eligibility. But we do see it. We see a real mix of folks who are falling through the cracks of the public, like they're not eligible, right? They're on those benefit cliffs where they're not eligible for emergency assistance, where this loan is sort of a great fit for folks who are in between, in those in-between moments of benefit cliffs. But we also have seen, especially in this resiliency loan pilot, folks that are stacking benefits with this loan to fix a car, because, you know, the grant or the public benefit won't go far enough for the car repair. And so actually at Neighbors Inc., there have been some stacking of, they have a private grant where they've stacked the grant and the loan to meet, you know, to meet the security deposit or to meet car repair. So it's a little bit of a mix.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. That raises another concern, and perhaps this would be a question for Representative Liebling. With the stacking of benefits, does that create any potential problems for the clients of receiving other additional income, or because it's a loan, would they be okay? Does that create other potential problems for them?
Not that we partner with, you know, Bridge to Benefits and other sort of, and I mean, you guys are benefits experts at the social service agencies. So far, I think because it's a loan, it's not savings, right? So you're not hitting those asset tests. Because it's a loan, it's not hitting those asset tests that are preventing you from claiming your benefit. But a good question.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my last question is then, what are the terms of the loans? What is the repayment like? How are folks doing with these loans?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Ms. Leland Clark.
Right now, so we just did the pilot, and 30 people enrolled in January and February. First payments are going great, so I can't report on repayment. But the terms of a loan are you up to $1,200 from 12 to 24 months. And our big sort of point of underwriting is we are going to make sure that your monthly payment to us does not exceed 8% of your income. We anchor closer to 4%, but we will not go over 8%. So our real underwriting is around income and making sure your payment to us, and that'll stretch the loan then from sometimes 12 to 24 months.
All right. Now I see no further discussion, so closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the discussion today. I think this is a critical next step in supporting lower-income Minnesotans, folks who are unable to utilize fee-based or interest-based loans. These are halal compliant. I know a lot of folks in my community have issues with that, and allowing people to build credit when they've been historically underbanked or unbanked. So I appreciate the work of Exodus, and I appreciate members' consideration.
Thank you. And with that, the bill is laid over. The last bill on our agenda today is House File 1336, also from Representative Katisa Watoon. Would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1336 to be before the committee for potential inclusion.
Representative Katisa Watoon moves House File 1336 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Katisa Watoon, to your bill.
Chair Stevenson and members, based on our just very brief previous conversation on the last bill, nobody really questions the need for Minnesota students and Minnesotans in general to understand personal finance. And this body has adapted state academic standards for economics and personal finance back in 2011. The problem, however, is that not all of Minnesota's teachers are adequately prepared in their undergraduate programs to effectively instruct their future students in personal finance topics. So this is where the Minnesota Council on Economic Education, or MCEE, comes in. MCEE is the primary Minnesota organization providing teachers the training and resources they need to confidently and effectively engage their students with financial literacy instruction. House File 1336 would appropriate from a Consumer Financial Literacy Education Fund within the Commerce Department $50,000 annually over the next 2 years to the Commissioner of Education to provide a grant to MCEE to partially support this organization to continue delivering teacher professional development programs aligned with these state standards. And I'm going to go ahead and give it over to my testifier.
All right. We're pleased to welcome back to the committee Julie Bunn. Ms. Bunn, if you could try and do about 2 minutes, that'd be great.
Less than that today. Thank you, Chair Stephenson and members. I appreciate this time. My name is Julie Bunn. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council on Economic Education. Our mission is to increase the financial and economic literacy of all Minnesotans. We've been doing this for over 60 years. MC has been working in the financial literacy education space since its founding. As Representative Katisa Watoon mentioned, personal finance is part of the elementary, middle school, and high school teachers deliver as part of the economic strand within social science standards. Personal finance is also sometimes included with life skills classes, family and consumer science classes, and business classes. And some schools offer freestanding courses for personal finance. MC trains the teachers in all of these categories to do what they are doing in the classroom. MC serves the mission to increase financial literacy of Minnesotans by training the teachers with courses and workshops, by developing and curating curriculum for K-12 teachers to use for personal finance, by providing student competitions related to personal finance, and also works to partner with people in the industry and the financial advising sectors to inform and advance this programming. This request for $50,000 from the special revenue account would help support all these described activities. In addition, over the next 2 years, MC, working with industry professionals, faculty in personal finance, and master teachers, is going to develop a certified personal finance course for high school teachers to be able to deliver this curriculum more effectively, particularly in a freestanding course. And over the past 2 years, or during the current year as well, we received a $150,000 grant for each of the last 2 years from this fund. MC has delivered all its delivers and goals for that grant, has produced reports as needed for that grant, and on the first page of the packet received today, there's a Z-link to the fiscal 22 report on all the activities under this previous grant. This is a smaller request for the next 2 years. We will continue to report likewise. Finally, just last 2 points, this has received bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. And very importantly, because I know there's a lot of discussion this session about nonprofits and accountability and transparency, in your packet under the case statement lists all the ways in which MCE is audited, scrutinized, gets seals of approval from all the nonprofit accountability agencies, and makes all its reports and documentation, 990s, annual reports, et cetera, available to the public at any time. So thank you for your consideration, and I hope you will support House File 1336. I'd be glad to answer questions.
Thank you. Discussion to the bill. Seeing none, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a good bill. MCE is a great organization, and I appreciate the consideration.
With that, the bill is laid over, and with that, our agenda is completed, and the committee is adjourned.